The Earth is a big mass of rock, third rock from the sun, we call it. And as we said earlier, it formed 4.5 billion years ago. For context, 24 million years ago, a mere yawn in geologic time, the place where we are sitting today was nothing like it is today. It was flat, no mountains or valleys, and it was underwater, as testified by my rock that I showed you earlier. The inner core of the Earth is solid metal, mostly iron, that gives the Earth its magnetic field. The outer core is liquid. Next comes the mantle, which is hot, hot, hot. It makes up 68% of the Earth's mass, and that's where volcanoes come from, you know. Next comes the 1% that makes up the Earth's crust, which is in constant movement. Tectonic plates come together and separate. Continents join together and move. Baja California separates from the rest of the continent. As permanent as it seems, it's all in fluid motion. We don't have the perception or the ability in time to see it. So, I was introduced to the wonders of geology by my father, who had gone back to college when I was still in junior high and high school. And he was amazed by the geologic ages of the Earth. And I inherited that wonder, although my fascination was expressed through the poet's imagination more than the rigor of the scientist's laboratory. In my world religions and cultural anthropology classes, I learned about animism. And animism is one of the earliest forms of human religious expression. And it comes from the word anima, which in Latin means soul or spirit. And original peoples believed that everything had soul or spirit, the mountains, the trees, the animals, the rocks. Now, this was a foreign idea to me, having grown up in Western culture, and I imagine it is to most of you. And then I learned that rocks are actually in constant motion at the subatomic level. Electrons are dancing around, and again, we do not have the capacity with our natural senses to observe it. Oh, of course, we know that we're much smarter than the primitive animists, right? Or are we? To me, there is life in everything. What we call spiritual and physical are really just different ways to talk about the same thing. It's all in your perception. We are inheritors of a Western Greek philosophy called dualism that separates body and spirit. And the New Testament in Christian scriptures adopted that dualism and treated the body and flesh as inferior, if not downright evil. Well, I don't accept that. I accept we are one whole spiritual, physical reality, and we are at heart children of the universe, children of the earth, newcomers, newborns, really, and we all belong. The beach is a great place to find beautiful stones, and the stones are great teachers. When I walk the beach and see a stone with obvious strata of sediment, broken from the mountain, washed and polished by the sea, waiting to fill my hand and skip across the water's surface, I am filled with wonder. We fit together, that stone and I. So in 1980, I had momentarily abandoned my graduate school studies and was painting houses for a living. I had no career path. I was married with three small children and aimless. No career path, no passion or guiding ambition to pull me along from sunrise to sunset. And my father had an idea he gave me. I didn't talk about what I was feeling inside, my disillusionment with life in general. But I think he was observing. He said he had bought a lot, and he said, why don't you, and he hired a young contractor, said, why don't you sort of act as his apprentice? You can learn how to build a foundation, how to frame a house, and then maybe one day you can do the same, which was the habit he had picked up, having built like six or seven houses for our family over the years. So that's what I did. It wasn't the dream I had, but it got me unstuck. And sure enough, in time, builder was one of the monikers I carried for the next several decades. The first thing we did was lay out the footprint of the house on this building pad. The lot had been rough graded, but we quickly learned the house wouldn't fit without some serious jackhammering. In fact, the architect came out and to look at, you know, what was happening with the house he designed. He says, boy, it just fits, doesn't it? And the young wise-ass contractor said, yeah, it just didn't fit. So jackhammering out a little more space on the mountain was the job of my brother and I for the next week. And we had to cut a 5-foot-high vertical wall into this solid rock. So as I worked this 40 and 60-pound jackhammer, we started with a 60-pound connected to a big compressor until we got too high and we couldn't even get the 60-pound that high. We switched to a 40-pound jackhammer, and there out popped out this ugly but beautiful seashell into my hand. And my curiosity was piqued. Aren't we at 800 foot elevation above sea level? How did a seashell get stuck in the mountain? And how long has it been there? So I told you a little earlier about it. The sea has risen and fallen in the Kaneo Valley, and we think about 2 to 4 million years ago was when my fossil was created. Most of us have driven by the Kaneo Mountain on the way to the Oxnard Plain from the Kaneo Valley. And I'm gonna ask that we, oh, there's my rock. That doesn't look too bad. I think it's an ordinary clam. Can we pull up the slide that shows, I forget the number, but it shows all the volcanic peaks in the Kaneo Valley. It's kind of small, but there's Dawn Hill, Dawn Peak, there is Kaneo Mountain, there's Mount Boni, and several others. Kaneo Mountain is now 1,800 feet above sea level, but it was once over 3 times that high. Geologists found fossilized pine cones that could only grow at an elevation of 8,000 feet. So we know that these volcanic eruptions have been eroding over time and filling in the valley, and you have what you see today. So go a little further east to the Grand Canyon, an awe-inspiring sight, if there ever was one. The Grand Canyon was created first as a plateau. It was uplifted, and then water erosion exposed over 40 major sedimentary rock layers ranging from about 200 million to 2 billion years. It's 6,000 feet over 1 mile deep at its deepest. On the south rim, if you've ever been there, you know there's the Trail of Time, where you can walk. Every meter you walk is a million years in time. And every few meters, there's a sample of the geologic layers that you can look at and marvel at. You don't have to like get down on a bungee cord and look for them. But none of these facts can prepare you for the gobsmacking beauty of this natural wonder. Or go visit Glacier Bay in Alaska, the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho, Yosemite, with its glacier-cut granite rock faces of El Capitan and Half Dome. I know many of you have been to these places. You feel yourself transcended beyond the daily grind in the city. What do these ancient geologic formations and fossils say about us? First of all, I think it tells us that our one wild, precious life, as Mary Oliver puts it, is recent, it's brief, and it's temporary. We are connected in a very long chain of elements and changes. This perspective ought to foster humility and appreciation for the earth of which we are an integral part. Several years ago, I was on a nature hike with Mary Fried, and I know some of you have been on Mary's hikes. We were in the Lang Ranch area, and she pointed out a hollowed out depression in the bedrock. Hold on a second. I have my pictures numbered here, so I'm gonna pull it up. If we can pull up. Oh, good. So this isn't the rock, but it's very similar. The one we saw was in a much bigger boulder. And what you're looking at, do you recognize what you're looking at? Go to the next slide, please.
It's the kitchen.
It's a mortar and pestle. And the Chumash would often make their mortar right in the rock where they lived, close to the water, where they could drink and filter the acorns that they would mash to take out the tannic acid and the bitterness and make cakes to cook and eat with their fish food and other food sources. So this isn't the only rock that the Chumash used. They made tools, scrapers, drills, spears. And when I saw this mortar in the rock, and knowing that my feet were literally in somebody's home, I was amazed at the harmonious existence of a people who knew their land and took care of it, and still, to this day, do so. So I want to talk about caves for a second. Caves were great structures where people made some of their earliest homes, and which they used to protect from the elements and from prey, predators, but also as canvas for their paintings. So eventually, people invented or discovered agriculture. So they moved their caves outside, which they built out of mud and straw, wood, or stones, starting around 10,000 BCE. In time, the largest and most extravagant structures we built, ziggurats, pyramids, and temples, were for religious and ceremonial use. Several years ago, Debbie and I took the train from London, and we headed west to Salisbury. Do you know where we're going? In southwest England. We stayed at a B&B, and then in the morning we got up and took a bus to Stonehenge, the 5,000-year-old stone circle shrouded in mystery. I came with low expectations by design. I had heard from so many people how disappointed they were when they finally got to see the site, that I was prepared to be unimpressed. I guess my strategy worked, because when the bus crested over that last hill before Salisbury Plain, and I caught my first glimpse of the stones gleaming in the morning light before a backdrop of blue sky and cumulus nimbus clouds, it took my breath away. Not too many decades ago, you could walk among the stones. Well, they've put a rope, as my friend Sally did. You could rest your back against the stone and ponder about the lives of the ancestors. Why did they build the stones, the structure? What were their lives like? Now the rope keeps you out, but you can still wonder. Theories abound on the purpose and meaning of the structure. English Heritage, which manages the site, says, today, the interpretation which is most generally accepted is that a prehistoric temple aligned with the movements of the sun is what it is. It is the most striking example of the ceremonial complexes emerging across Britain and Ireland at this time. Places to honor the ancestors and mark important moments in the calendar. At the center of this belief system was the sun, with the solstice alignments enshrined within the monument. So you can look up the kind of stones that are there. There's basically two types, and they range in weight from 4 tons to 30 tons. And some of them come from 150 miles away. It took a lot of effort to get those stones where they are. Legend has it that the wizard Merlin moved them. Let me just say, you are welcome. But the mystery remains. Time and again, we seem to strive to impress our deepest values in the relative permanence of stone. Here, there at Stonehenge, there is a connection to the natural relation of earth and sun, and deep attention to human burial. If you look at the giant statues of Easter Island, which represent the inhabitants' ancestors, or the obelisks of Egypt and Greece, the Parthenon, the Mayan cities, even the Washington Monument, all seem to point to humanity's aspiration toward immortality and ancestry. Traveling across country at the age of 10 with my family, we made a stop at Mount Rushmore. And we looked at the blasted faces of Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt. If America had a social media account, Mount Rushmore would be one of its profile pictures. There is something to admire about each of the characters represented. Nation felt inclined to stamp its national ethos on the natural environment in a permanent way. Now, I like to think our respect for the environment has evolved to the point that such an invasive endeavor would most likely never be approved. And now I also know what I did not know at age 10, that the rock sculpture was carved into sacred land that belongs to the Lakota, according to treaties. The treaties were violated because gold was found and the land was confiscated by the government. So I can see why the Lakota are particularly galled to have the oppressor's symbols carved into their stolen sacred land. Figures cut from granite and marble dot the landscape of the world and our country. A stone mountain in Georgia, in a 90-foot sculpture, children of the Confederacy carved a monument to their heroes and their cause. Around the country, north and south, you can see many more such examples, though fewer of them now than a few years ago. And in the East, followers of the egoless Buddha can't help but carve his image. People will impress their dearest values into durable stone, as if to say or hope that this will last beyond our individual lives. This is forever. But there's one more stone or use of stone I want to talk about. Well, we could talk about the ancient and contemporary labyrinths, often but not always made of stone, that appear across the globe. Some say the labyrinth symbolizes a journey through life's complexities, transformation, self-discovery, and growth. A labyrinth can encourage reflection and meditation. But that's for another time. I want to talk about the Zen garden. A Zen garden consists usually of a bed of sand or gravel, meticulously raked in straight lines or curves, with a few stones laid on it. Perhaps a plant or two, but no flowers. Rather than making a human representation, the Zen garden underscores the idea of perfection in imperfection, or wabi-sabi, which means everything is imperfect, impermanent, and incomplete. And that's what makes it beautiful. Isn't it ironic to see our ancient permanent creations in ruins? Venus de Milo with her missing arms, Stonehenge and the Parthenon in ruins, monuments to both our longing for permanence and expressions of the immutability of change. In other words, nothing stays the same as much as you want it to be. So what to make of all this talk of stones? Before human culture, before humans, there is the earth. There is stone. First of all, let's recognize the power and beauty of it all. Remember your place of belonging within it. We belong to the earth. Love the earth. Love yourself. Spread love. We have an irresistible urge to interact artistically with the elements of nature, with stone. What we make reveals what we most care about. I would like to write a poem about the world that has in it nothing fancy, wrote Mary Oliver. But it seems impossible. As for the stones on the beach, forget it. Each one could be set in gold. As for spiders, how the dew hangs in their webs, even if they say nothing or seem to say nothing. So fancy is the world. Who knows, maybe they sing too. And the ants and the peonies and the warm stones. So happy to be where they are, on the beach, instead of being locked up in gold. For me, a walk on the beach, a stone that fits my hand, the sound of the ocean that shaped it, and the sand on my feet reconnects me to my home. I breathe and learn again to love. Now, I think we're going to sing.